And our main speaker tonight is Clancy.
My name is Clancy Imislund, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here this evening for this notable affair, 21 years. I've been here to speak at 21 anniversaries for you. And no one's ever stayed for a second time. I don't know why. I want to thank Marlene, who has been my hostess since I've been in town. I've been her sponsor for almost 50 years now. And when she left Los Angeles, she was a bimbo, a blonde bimbo. And she came here and became a distinguished lawyer. I can't believe it still. But she did. But I'm glad to be here this evening. I'm glad to see the balconies full. We always used to call that the half measures group up there. Welcome. And they wave. But we're all here to celebrate 21 years of this anniversary of this group, which is a lively, involved group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to talk just a little bit. I know we have some new people here who aren't terribly involved as yet with AA. And I had a terrible time with Alcoholics Anonymous. What do you... You're in the meeting now. You can turn off your phone. I just try to help people as I see. Turn off your goddamn phone. But I had a great deal of difficulty with AA because of one thing. And over the years, I've come to believe this is the most critical problem of anyone's sobriety, accepting the first step. I mean, it's easy to put up your hands, see, I'm an alcoholic, but down deep in your gut, you know you're really not. You know that your case is different, and they don't understand it. And most everybody has gone through that phase, and I went through it, and I came in kind of a high-bottom drunk, and then I became a medium-bottom drunk, and the last day I drank, two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission and said, "Don't come back." And I tried to explain to him, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the Elsie and Alvarez for the Borden Company, were running the New Yorker, Serving Post, Collier's. I've had my picture in the New York Times on the front page once. But it's hard to explain these things midair. And I stood outside of that damn old mission in downtown Skid Row in Los Angeles, raining. And one thing I'd learned over the years as I ran in and out of AA in different cities, and that is this: if you choose to become a long-term slipper, you might want to remember this. And that is that you, when you really get to a point where you smell bad and look bad and nobody wants anything to do with you anymore, there's one place you're always welcome: an AA club. It's the only place in the world where the worse you look, the better they like it. "This one's mine, Jimmy." And I said to some mope on the street in the rain, I said, "Where's an AA club around here?" And he said, "There's no club down around here. There's one at Wilshire and Fairfax." I said, "Where the hell's that?" He said, "Well, you go up this street, go over to Union, cross over to Wilshire, walk west till you get there." And I did that. Doesn't sound bad, does it? Turn out to be 7.5 miles in the rain. Then when I got to the club, I almost didn't go in. Just inside of the door, there was some fool standing there saying, "Welcome home, son." Oh, shit. But I went in, and I had no idea that would be my sobriety date. I didn't intend for it to be. I noticed tonight they've changed this. In some areas, they still read the only requirement for membership is an honest desire to stop drinking. I've never known anyone that had an honest desire to stop drinking. I guess there are such people, but they're not in my area. Just a desire to get the heat off is all you need, really. And then all the rest can come later. But I went to this club, and the guy, the manager of the club, looked at me, and he said, "You smell bad." And I said, "Thank you." He said, "You have to be a member of this club during the week to come in here. On the weekends, you can come in like this is Saturday. But next week, you have to have a membership or you can't come in." And so I said, "All right." But I hung there all day long. and I had no place to sleep. And the manager of the club said, out there is a 49 Merc in the parking lot. You can sleep in that. So I said, okay. So I slept in the 49 Merc in the parking lot. Went on Sunday, and they had a big religious meeting going on. I ate all their cake. And I went in my car that night, cold and hungry and sick and desperate. Monday morning, I started to go in. I happened to think, I can't go in the club. What am I going to do? And the manager was standing there. He said, you know, I've been thinking about you, kid. He said, you're going to die in this parking lot, obviously. You're going to die any moment. And I will have to write up some reports. So come on in. Don't hang out in the parking lot. So I went in there, and he said, there are three rules you have to follow if you want to stay sober. One, you can't ask anyone for money. None of your sarcastic remarks, which you've already used. And you must go to a meeting in this club every night. And I thought, this is a fate worse than death, almost. But I went to a meeting Monday night, and they served chocolate cake, and I had about 4 pounds of that. Because I had just had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix jail, and I wasn't really chewing quite as well as I'd like to. And then somebody at that meeting talked about gratitude for an hour. And I almost puked the cake. But then I went to a meeting every night that week, ate a lot of cake. And in a couple of those meetings, I saw a guy that I'd seen in the movies. I thought, aha, we know he's an actor and he's making a lot of money. I'm sure he needs a new friend. And so I kind of moved in on him. It turned out he didn't need a new friend, apparently. He rejected my advances. And by Friday, I was doing very badly. I weighed 120-some pounds, and I'd lost everything in the world, and I had no place to turn. And I had to do something. I knew I was going to die. So I sold out. I did my last sellout. And I knew all about AA by this time. But I went up to this goof, and I said, Bob, I really admire your program. I said nicely without teeth. I really admire your program. Would you be my sponsor? He said, all right, kid, but I want you to tell you. I said, sure, Bob. I thought, I'll have some money out of your pocket and be gone out of here by tomorrow morning. But it turned out I found out soon thereafter he wasn't a famous movie actor at all. He'd had 3 cameos in movies, and I'd seen 2 of them. So I thought he was a big shot, and he wasn't. I've been in more movies in the last few years than he ever saw, but I didn't know that then. And then they said he wasn't a very good actor, but he was a good actor because he acted well in meetings, and that took a lot of acting for him because he was a right-wing fascist AA pig of the worst sort, just terrible. Do this, do that. I thought, why am I taking this crap from this idiot? Because he, my only meal ticket out of there. And he just said, you got us a meeting now. And then I was out in this car. He lives out in Westwood somewhere. And we got into a little pattern once or twice a week where he would call the club and say, tell that kid to be ready at 6 o'clock. I'm going to pick him up. He'd come down in his big car and pick me up. He'd buy me dinner, scrambled eggs or something I could chew. And then he'd take me to the meeting he was speaking at. He was a big deal speaker, which I didn't mind, except I heard him talk so much I could have given his talk. And on the way home, he'd fill me full of his opinions, which were strong and non-challengeable. And I just, oh, God. I don't know which I hated worse. And one day I just got so tired of listening to him talk that I thought I might as well broach a new subject. I said, Bob, you know, I really appreciate your efforts to give me a ride and buy my dinner and everything. I said, but, you know, I just thought you should know I'm not really an alcoholic. He said, I figure that, kid. Good. I said, I want to ask you a question, though. I've been going to AA all over the country, off and on, had got different jobs. And every meeting, it seems like there's always some boob talking about how much he's lost. I lost my family. I lost my car. I lost my home. I lost my job. If it's so bad, why do they keep drinking? Why do these boobs keep drinking when they lose things? He said, well, you don't quite understand, young man. He said, I don't think you really understand. You know what you're talking about. He said, alcoholics, let me tell you what an alcoholic is. You know what an alcoholic is? I said, that's the person who sits drunk all the time. He says, no, not at all. An alcoholic is a person who gets unnatural reaction from drinking. He says, you know what that is? I said, of course I do. I've been in all of these meetings. It sets up the phenomenon of craving. Then they drink, 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 drink till they go crazy. He said, nah, that's podium talk. He had a cup of coffee in his hand, which is more than I've got. Who's in charge of this? Can somebody bring up a piece of paper and read us something about filling his cup? Oh, don't go any bother for me. But anyway, now I've lost my place and I have to start over. My name is Clancy Imeslund and I'm an alcoholic. He said, he had a cup of coffee in his hand. He said, kid, people don't drink to lose things. I'll tell you why alcoholics drink alcohol. He said, if this were Johnny Walker, and I took a big drink. The result would be to almost instantly alter my perception of reality, to make it a friendlier world, a little more colorful. Then I'd have another drink to hold that one down, and then the magic of alcohol kicks in. All of a sudden, I go from being a shy, useless introvert into Sam Slick from Slickville. Hi, baby. I used to have hair and do this. I love that. And drink the night away until they pretty soon it's closing time. Then you can sidle over to the front row and say, you with anyone, Granny? I did a lot of drinking in bars over the years, so I took a lot of girls home. But the one thing I was proud of that I tried to hold true, I never took an ugly girl home. I awakened with a lot of them. Jesus. Who are you and where's that girl I brought home? But he pointed out to me that the story of being an alcoholic was entirely different than I always knew. I heard people talk about being an alcoholic. I drank all the time. I stayed drunk all the time. And that isn't it at all. You must be one in 10 of drinkers who gets an unusual effect from alcohol. And that unusual effect from alcohol, it has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for most people. It doesn't want to do, by the time it's doing things to you, it's much too late. It's doing things for you. And I remember that so well, much of my adult life, when I needed to do something that was beyond my power, I had a couple drinks and I could do it. I had my first drink on a ship outside of Pearl Harbor, right after the Second World War started. I was only 15, I'd run away from home. And I hated it. And I never drank alcohol until I got, after the war, went to the university. And the veterans all ran around in a pack. And so I got to learn to drink. And about halfway through my freshman year, I started to get a different reaction from alcohol. It started to do something that made me feel good. And it really was great. I started to become active. I became Chief Justice Chief Justice of the Student Court and editor of the campus newspaper, star of the shows. And alcohol enabled me to do things that I don't seem to be able to do comfortably on my own. And over the years, I drank for that reason. And many times, I studied myself. Why am I drinking so much? And I'm not drinking so much because I'm an alcoholic. I'm drinking because I just don't seem to know when to quit. Because I'm not going to quit drinking, but I got to find a way not to drink so much. I thought that was unique unto me until some years later I read it in chapter 3 when it talks about the obsession we all have. Alcoholics like us have the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. It says the pursuit goes on and on till you die from it. And I know that's true because I've presided over funerals of people who died from it, waiting to control and enjoy their drinking. But I always knew that alcohol itself was the best friend I ever had. Bring me a ham on rye when you come back. This is a tough place. I might as well leave too, should I? There's a big sign here, do not put your anything on the piano. But I'm a resistor of such things, and I put my elbow on it for half an hour. But anyway, alcohol is my best friend. I mean, friends come and go, lovers come and go, jobs come and go, cities come and go, states come and go. But a few drinks is just altering your perception of reality to where you want it to be. It's just grand. And the only problem I ever had is how I drink too much, I get in trouble. I remember asking Bob, I said, Bob, you know, I've got a bunch of kids at home. And I leave work, or did used to when I had a job, leave work, determined to go home and have dinner with my kids and have a couple drinks on the way. And I stop in there for a couple drinks, and the next thing I know, it's 1 o'clock. They're closing up. And I just hate it. Why is that? He said, kid, that's exactly the description of alcoholism. That when you take those two drinks, the guy that wanted to come home for dinner, he's gone. The guy that's here for the evening, Sam Slick, is ready to go and will be there until they close him up. I said, Jesus, Bob, I love to drink, but I don't, you know, I've all these meetings, they say alcoholics are people who can't stop drinking. I can stop drinking. I've stopped drinking many times. This is the signal for laughter. This is a signal for muffled sobs. Now what? Now what? Got another announcement? Jesus. Good time. This is a busy meeting, I'll tell you that. I think someone ought to tell you, getting into action means with newcomers. Anyway, I know what to do about alcohol, but how can I stop on the way? He said, you really can't, kid. I'm afraid you're just not going to do that. He said, that's what makes it so tough. Alcoholics are people who get a change of perception. And then they do have that phenomenon of craving, and he had a reason for it. In all of AA's history, there's never been any definition of this phenomenon of craving, but there is. He said, as far as he was concerned, you now become a new persona, and you just start to sag a little bit, and you instinctively drink to hold it, till you sag a little bit, and you instinctively hold it, and all of a sudden you're drunk. But nobody cares. And you can't explain why you kept drinking. But I suppose it boiled down to, I'd want to go back there when this is available. And I thought, that's a reasonable chance. I said, you know, but I can stop drinking. I've stopped drinking, but I came from a very religious family in Wisconsin. And I sometimes get a terrible sense of remorse over my own badness and sinfulness and so on. And sometimes things happen that change me. In Texas one time, I was in jail. And I got out of jail in the morning. And I said, you should have stayed out of jail last night because your little boy died and we couldn't find you. And that just about killed me. I stopped drinking that time, I'll tell you. And my wife and I took him up to northern Wisconsin, buried him in a little country churchyard next to his grandmother. And I put my hand in his casket. I said, John Emmisland, this will never happen again. I won't ever allow this. I felt so bad. And I didn't drink. But always, when I stopped drinking, what happened to me was this. After a few days, someone seems to sneak into my bedroom and put an invisible string in my gut. And the next day, somebody tightens it. And it doesn't come out as, I need a drink. It just comes out as, just a little restlessness, irritability. People are such jerks. And you fight against it, but eventually, I'll tell you how you beat it. Eventually, you have a drink. Oh. But then you must say, this time I'll watch it. But you don't, because you can't. Because somebody else takes control. I said, when my little boy died, I stopped drinking, and it didn't happen. Nobody came in. I start coming home from work and stopping, not at all, and going home and having dinner with my kids and helping them with their schoolwork, taking them for rides, and doing fun things. And after about 25 days, one day somebody snuck into my bedroom. And so the next day, I was a little tense. Not that I know what this is. This is that same old crap again. I can stand this for baby John, because I promised him I would. And the days went by, and I got more and more tense and more irritable and more upset. One morning I got up, I just wanted to scream. I go to the kitchen and get some coffee, for Jesus. And there was no coffee. My wife had taken the children to church, left a note, we're going to church. Who cares about you going to church? I want some coffee. And I realized the world was just a crappy place. I went out in the garage, put a hose from my exhaust pipe into my car, turned the motor and went to sleep and died. I was so crazy, I just couldn't think of a thing to do. The guy next door was sitting in his breakfast nook having a cup of coffee and saw me go in there and heard the motor running. I didn't come out. So he walked over there and found me dead in the car, and he pulled me out, and he beat in my chest, and he rushed me to the hospital, oxygenated me, and worked on me for a few days. Then they thought maybe they should check my emotions. And they determined that I was seriously emotionally ill and committed me to the state insane asylum for an indefinite period. Now that's how I get to when I stop drinking, folks. Alcohol is not my problem. I got to find a way to control it. I'll tell you, I almost didn't get out of that nut house, his wretched, insolent attendants. But the next year I was still there. And one of these big jerks came up to me and says, don't ever try to escape from here, boy. This is an escape-proof hospital. I said, oh, really? Oh. Took me about 2 weeks to find a way to get down a corridor and through a door and down another corridor and out the door and over the fence. And this Sam Slick was loose in West Texas. And then I suddenly realized it is an escape-proof hospital. I don't know if you've ever been to West Texas. They can see you running for 3 days out there. Well, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. And they snatched me back, gave me 2 months of electric shock treatment for that run. That slows you down. But the point I'm trying to make is I can stop drinking if the reason is sufficient. It's just that it becomes intolerable. One time I spent almost $10,000 in psychoanalysis to try to find a way to beat that need to drink. And I took their pills and I read their book and I went to their meetings. And it all postpones it for a little while. But the day must come for me, and I think for you. I I can't take it anymore. And then you face your loved ones. That's one of the great things about drinking again, is that I'm sure everyone in this room somewhere along the line has had somebody love them. You look in their face and they're just, oh, how could you? You promised, and you were doing better, and the kids were doing better, and you promised you're going to hold this job and we're going to get out of debt, and now you're drunk again. How could you do that to us? What's the answer to that? Leave me alone. Get off my back, you old bag. Terrible. But I said to Bob, you know, Bob, the way you describe it, that's the story of my life for the last 10 years. He said, well, there's a name for people like you. And I hate to ask him what it was because he was so profane. Just a terrible garbage mouth. There goes another one escaping. And I think this is an interesting story. I wouldn't leave. This man may never get sober. He may die at the podium. Who knows? But I said, what am I, Bob? He said, as far as I can see, I believe you're an alcoholic. I said, Bob, Jesus, I know. Everybody thinks I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not. I thought you'd understand. How could I be an alcoholic when my number one problem is not really alcohol? He said, alcoholics aren't people whose number one problem is alcohol, kid. Alcoholics are people whose number one answer is alcohol. And if it's your answer, that'll be your problem till you die from it. And he told me that in early December of 1958. And I was sober 4 weeks living in an abandoned car. God, what if that's true? I don't believe I'm an alcoholic, no matter what he says. But maybe I'm kind of one. I'll try to do what he says. So I made a little vow to try to do what he says for the hell of it. But then he said the words that send the shiver down his spine, people. We're going to go through the steps. Uh-oh. Because when you sit in meetings and there's a boring speaker, you read the steps on the wall. I think, Jesus, is that a broken pattern or what? You're going to admit your problem is alcohol. Then you're going to return to God. Then you're going to ask God to take care of things. Try that when you can't pay your rent. Here, God. Boom. Then you're going to write all your secrets down and tell them to some blabbermouth. Did you know I used to be married to a sheep outside of Butte, Montana? And then you're going to ask God to get rid of all your defects. You can be like all the people you've always secretly hated. Have little thin blue lips and hump. Then you're going to make amends to people who've been screwing you for 20 years. Here's $10. I hope it wasn't too much of an inconvenience to call the police on me. And there's a great step on meditation, which is wonderful for people like me. That's what I really need to do, is sit in a dark room and think about things. You want to just have your pistol right with you. See? So what's the reward if you get through all that crap? You're going to be allowed to drive across town in the rain and tell some other jerk about it. Not really an exciting plan of action. He said, I'm going to take you through the pill. It should take you through the steps. But I had a pert answer for him. I said, I can't go through the steps, Bob, because the second step I can't take. He said, why not? I said, because I cannot return to God. When my little boy died, I shook my fist at God and said, God, you Norwegian Lutheran son of a bitch, you killed my little boy that never had a sin in his life to get to make them bad. To hell with you, God. You'll get me in hell, but you won't get me to land. I'm staying away from all the... And from that time on, I try to avoid any mention of God. And he said, well, you're lucky, kid. In the second step, nothing says you have to return to God. Oh, to a power greater than myself? Is that supposed to fool me? Why don't you read it? It says, we came to believe. We started from where we were, whatever, wherever that is, and came from there. He said, can't you come to believe in a loving God? I said, no. He said, can't you believe in AA? And I said, well, I like it better than I used to, but not much. He said, you think I'm doing better than you are, you little puke? I said, yes, you are, Bob. He said, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And I could accept that because he's trying to help me. And he had me do things that I thought were stupid. I wouldn't do it for my father, I wouldn't do it for anybody else. I did little things. And then eventually we had gone to he had me write a fourth step. I wasn't going to write a fourth step. Why did I write my fourth step for the jerks like him? But the day I got fired as a dishwasher, it wasn't my fault. I was working at the Gaty Delicatessen on Sunset Strip, and I noticed that the busboys were bringing in more dishes than the waitresses were taking out. So I realized they were getting them from other restaurants to persecute me because I'm an Anglo. I just piled them up. I got back to the club that night after I got fired. The manager was sitting there. I said, Sullivan, I got fired as a dishwasher. I can't do anything. I used to be somebody big. I can't even hold a job as a dishwasher. I might as well be drunk. I was waiting for him to start the, oh no, don't get drunk, John. And he said, good idea. I said, what does that mean, Sully? He said, there's 150 members of this club. 142 of them think you're a jerk. 8 of them spend their days defending you. Now, if you just get drunk tonight, you could make 142 of them feel good. You might hurt the guys that like you, but screw them. I said, no, I wouldn't do that. I won't drink. I'll show them. I got some paper, and I wrote a piece of paper. I wrote down, oh, God, stuff I had never tried to think about ever. I'm not even a big deal bad man, but I'm just a chicken shit bad man. If there's some crappy way to do it, I'll do it. And I got done, and I don't know if I felt better or not, but I know the manager of the club probably called my sponsor, because he called me the next morning and says, I understand you wrote your sponge, wrote your inventory. I said, how did you find out? He said, sponsors know these things. Be ready at 6 o'clock. I'm going to pick you up with your inventory. We're going to drive to Oxnard along the ocean. You're going to take your fifth step. I said, Bob, I can't do that. I got the stuff there that I've never even thought about. I have to assimilate it. I just said, Jesus. Oh, shut up, he says. So he got to 6 o'clock. He picked me up. We went along the ocean to Oxnard. And I read this to him. Oh, God, it was such a despicable creature. It's just, I wish I'd been a killer or a bank robber or something. Just sneak, liar, cheat, thief. I'm all done now, Bob. So are you sure you're done? Yeah. He said, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. And I said, thought it was. And he asked me to kneel down and pray to ask God to remove my defects of character. But I didn't have enough time to pray that long. Then he had me make amends. That's really a great step. I remember he said, the guy in Texas, when they repossessed your car and you stole his truck, you have to go back and make amends to him. So I saved my money. Finally got a round-trip ticket to Dallas. And I went to see him. I said, Doug, I'm here to make amends to you for overtaking the truck. He said, well, you should make amends. How come you're doing this? I said, I'm an AA now. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm trying to work the steps. He said, what are you doing in AA? I said, I'm an alcoholic. I never thought you were an alcoholic. Well, what did you think I was? I thought you were an asshole. I'm really glad I saved all that money. But on the other hand, he had me go back to the University of Wisconsin, where I'd been expelled shortly before graduation, and to go back and see the dean had become the chancellor, and he wouldn't even see me, because I'd really screwed up badly. And finally, he saw me. I said, "You know, Mr. Chancellor, I came back to tell you that I'm sorry I got the, I know you tried to cover for me, and I broke your heart, and I'm terribly sorry." He said, "Well, you should be." And that was the end of that. And in the meantime, I had done very well in AA. When I was 15 years sober, I got a big house out in the west side of town. My wife and children returned to me from Texas, and I was holding big jobs in Beverly Hills. I remember thinking one day, I don't know anybody who was down lower than I was who made such a comeback in such a short time. And it really almost made me feel guilty about it. I whipped myself around on that one for a while till I finally found myself resigning my job in Beverly Hills to take a job of running the mission that threw me out on the last day I drank. People say, "Why did you give up your great job to run a stinking mission?" And I have no answer for that. Well, it was such a big decrease in salary, I couldn't pass it up. And so I got caught up in it, and I've been there 40 years now. That's what I still do, 40 years later. But I, one day I was sitting at the mission doing my wonderful, kindly work. I got a call from the University of Wisconsin. She said, "Hello, this is the chancellor's secretary. He knows that you and he don't get along very well, but perhaps you could help us for old time's sake. We were supposed to have an alumni luncheon there next week, and the man that's supposed to set it up, we just discovered, is dead. Could you possibly help us?" I said, "I'll call you back." I called him back in about an hour. I said, "Yes, you're in luck. You're going to meet in the one of the hottest places in the world, the Coconut Grove, the Ambassador Hotel, where the big stars go every night, and you're going to have Sunday afternoon lunch there." And I didn't tell her. I sponsored the manager. That's how we got it. I said, "But on one condition, I got to be invited, even though I'm not a graduate." She said, "I'll call you back." And so she called me back and said, "Yeah, you can come." So that Sunday, a week and a half later, the chancellor and I, sitting there holding our coffee, he says, "What's this I hear about you trying to help people on Skid Row?" I said, "Yeah, that's what I do." He said, "That doesn't sound right. You are the most self-centered person I've ever known in my life. I've never known you to do anything for anybody at any time unless there was something in it for you. What's in it for you?" I said, "No, just do it." He said, "Well, let me see this place. Let me see it in all its pristine purity. Let's go over there right now. Don't call them and tell them we're coming. Let's just go over there and see it." I said, "Okay." So we went over there Sunday afternoon, sparkling clean. Old street guy saying, "Hi, Mr. Clancy. Hi, Mr. Clancy." We went into my office. I had some trophies and stuff I won. He said, "I can't believe this. I cannot believe this. This is beyond human comprehension." But that was the end of that. So then, November the next year, I got a call from the University of Wisconsin. The girl said, "Do you know the chancellor is retiring this year?" I said, "No. Wish him well. God bless him." She said, "And he has named you Distinguished Alumnus of the Year. Can you speak at commencement?" "Yes, I can." And so I went back to all my kids, and my folks were still alive. I'm so glad they sat and cried, because that was the heartache, broke their hearts so many times. And I became Distinguished Alumnus of the Year. That was the end of that. Wonderful occasion. Great amend to make. Then the next year, the chancellor retired, and I have to screw everything up. I started writing little notes to the university. "Isn't it kind of bad to have an alumnus of the year who is not really an alumnus, who's an expelled student?" They wrote me some long letter, some rationale. I said, "I know, but..." Next year, I wrote him another little letter, funny. I did that year after year. It made me feel better. One day, a package came in the mail with my diploma in it. He said, "Here's your damn diploma. Keep your notes, stick them up your nose." So if you ever come to my office in Los Angeles, you'll see on the wall, "Distinguished Alumnus of the Year, 1980. Graduate, 1987. But what I'm trying to say is this. Much to my surprise over the years, the only therapy I had since 1958 when I got sober are the 12 steps and good instructors in them. And if you're kind of new or frightening, I understand why you're taken aback by them. But they actually work. They actually work. And they don't work for sometimes for people because they don't do them. They don't take them. I think it's good if you have a sponsor who kind of intimidates you. It'll help you do things that you didn't know you were able to do. But I've lived a successful life. I hear, to this day, I go around to a lot of places because I've been active all these years. In the last couple of years, I've been in Bangkok and Rio de Janeiro, and a couple of months ago, I was in Spain, and been a lot of countries, a lot of places, different parts of the world. And it's a funny thing. When you get past the externals, they're all the same. You hear people in another group in another country saying the same crap you hear in your group. You know, well, I thought she loved me. Yeah, we know that one. Yeah. Well, they're screwing me around at work. Yeah, I know. We know that one. It's amazing how similar we all are under the skin. And the greatest thing about AA is this. It's made of people, all of whom have hated to come here, hated the term alcoholic. And after you're here a while, what's the worst thing you can say about anybody? I don't even think that son of a bitch is alcoholic. Yes, I am. Yes, I am. But it's a great thing. And that's why this celebration is important. This is no more important than any other group celebration, but it's important because it's a big group full of activists. And they are people who take the actions of AA, and they try to help people. They try to show them the way. The founder of this organization, he's a doctor named Dr. Bob Smith. When he was dying, he gave a talk at the first convention of AA, and they helped him to the podium because he wanted so much to share with these people before he died. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. He said, and let us, secondly, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and love and understanding. Is the person in this room or any room like it who doesn't know exactly what he's talking about? When things are going our way, we're just, oh. Love's the answer, baby. But unless somebody hurt our feelings. And finally he said, none of us would be here tonight if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to show us around, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it, to take us to a few meetings. Let us never reach that stage of smug complacency where we no longer have time to help our brother who suffers in the world of alcoholic despair. Such a nice thing. And then he sat down dead shortly thereafter. But the one thing to remember at this anniversary, a lot of people, a lot of excitement, a lot of fun, but Alcoholics Anonymous tonight in this meeting is exactly what they had in 1935 in Akron, Ohio. Looks different, sounds different, but it's always the same. One alcoholic talking to another alcoholic to help him reduce his feelings of being different at least enough so that he may take an action he does not yet believe in. And that is the gem of Alcoholics Anonymous. Then you have to kind of blow on it, and you surround yourself by people who are going the same direction. Stay away from the slick guys. And eventually you'll... The goal of Alcoholics Anonymous is what? You may wonder. Just to stay sober till you're sober forever? Not at all. The goal of Alcoholics Anonymous, its sponsors, its actions, its meetings, its steps, is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast, to change my perception of reality. I'm not the guy you'd ordinarily think of who says my prayers to God every night. And I would have bet my life that never would happen, but it happens today. And I live with some degree of comfort. I live with a degree of peace. And Wednesday morning or Thursday morning, tomorrow morning I'll be on the plane, but I'm going to do something that none of you are going to do. They're playing our song. Anyway, I'm going to do something that you're not going to do. I'm going to get up early, and I'm going to jump in my car and drive through Beverly Hills, where I used to get off and go to work, and go to Skid Row, where people are dying, park my car underneath our building, and then take a walk around the building and see who died in my absence, who died of smashing their head into the sidewalk with a convulsion, or overdose on crack, or all the crap. God, it's dreadful. Then I'll go in and we'll all talk all day long. How can we get these poor bastards off the street before they die? Because it's almost impossible to get people off Skid Row. Not because it's economically difficult, but the curse, it took me years to understand, the curse of the Skid Row mind is this. They no longer can handle conflict. When there's conflict, they back off into alcohol or drugs. And we'll... Jesus, must be important. You didn't hear it, but a man here has got a phone. Wow. Electronic. When I try sometimes to explain how Bill Wilson found a phone to call in Akron, I said about the big black payphones on the wall, and all the kids say, huh? How do you get them in your hand? But the point of Alcoholics Anonymous is this. It is to make you feel like you belong, to feel like you're involved, to feel like you're something inside of you, that cowering, ne'er-do-well, guilty runaway. And instead look in the mirror and think, you're all right. Nothing special, but you're all right. And to be able to stand up and proudly say, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm so proud that I am safe and sober and sane because of all of this. Hang in.
My name is Bob and I'm an alcoholic, and I was the chair in the Atlantic Group in 2008. Let's all thank Clancy for giving a great AA talk. In the spirit of Rule 62, which is not taking ourselves too seriously, it is our custom on our anniversary night to have an entertainment spot. So please help me welcome the AG Troubadours, Brooke, Matt, Wilma, Gina, Maggie, and Katie.
He's a real sober man, residing in AG land, a power of example to you and me. He only wants to help you. He knows there's much action to do. Will he please sponsor you and me? Sober man, please help to understand what's missing. Sober man, the steps are at your command. You're the driest I can be. Never thought of you and me. Sober man, how are you so serene? Sober man, don't worry, has clean time, must hurry to take you through the steps once and for all. He only wants to help you, knows there's much action to do. Will he please sponsor you and me. Sober man, please help to understand what's missing. Sober man, the steps are at your command. He's a real sober man, residing in H.G. land, a power of example to you and me. A power of example to you and me. A power of example to you and me.
My name is Cynthia, and I'm an alcoholic, and I chair the Atlanta group. Will Lisa and the cake team bring up the cake now, please? Happy anniversary to you. Happy anniversary to you. Happy anniversary. Thank you, girl.
Go in.
Yay. Woohoo. Okay, let's thank Clancy one more time. Darling, thank you. You have heard a typical AA meeting. We hope you will return and bring a friend. Atlanta Group has 6 other meetings. For time and place, see the bulletin board with our meeting list. If you have any questions regarding the Atlanta Group or Alcoholics Anonymous, please see any of our members after the meeting. Will all group members please raise your hands? And now for all who care to join, we have a nice way of closing. Whose father?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done.